Iran slaps retaliatory sanctions on nearly 40 European and British entities and individuals in response to bans imposed on Iranian individuals and entities. Italian Prime Minister rules out the supply of fighter jets to Ukraine, adding, however, that her country will continue to support Kiev. And a U.S. judge rules victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks are not entitled to seize assets of Afghanistan's central bank as compensation. Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, Iran has imposed sanctions on a number of individuals and entities from the European Union and the UK a day after they made a similar move against the Islamic Republic. Sanctions list includes 28 names from the EU and 8 from Britain. Tehran says that individuals and organizations were involved in supporting terrorism and instigating violence against the Iranian people. It also accused them of interfering in Iran's domestic affairs and spreading false information against the country. EU and UK slapped sanctions on dozens of Iranian individuals and entities over recent riots in the country. The West has accused Iran of cracking down on protesters. Tehran, though, has repeatedly dismissed that allegation, saying it has lawfully dealt with rioters who are disrupting public security. Meanwhile, Iran says certain European countries are in no position to preach others on international law while they do not adhere to such norms and they violate human rights. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani said those Western countries have jailed large numbers of Iranian nationals on baseless accusations and without charge. Spokesman said those countries have replaced international conventions with their own political and non-legal rulings. He said they have no respect for prisoners of other countries and their jails. Official said that Tehran is compliant with its international obligations. Now, on Monday, the European Union slapped sanctions against several Iranian judicial authorities over their response to recent riots in the country. The Central Bank of Iran, the CBI, has opened a new gold and currency exchange center in a bid to regulate market fluctuations, to stabilize market rates, and control speculative trade. Gisu Mishahmadi has your details.
Bringing currency volatility under control is the name of the game for the new governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, who is charged with getting a grip on the Iranian rial and devising new strategies to alleviate the country's economic woes amid unprecedented Western sanctions. And to do so, he has unveiled a new golden currency exchange center in an effort to regulate market fluctuations, or in his own words, stabilize market rates by adjusting demand and supply. But most importantly, as a powerful tool to control speculative inflation. For those familiar with Iran's economy, the most essential economic parameter that can effectively tip the scales.
We have enough resources to provide for all demands for exchange. The main challenge we are facing is speculative inflation as a consequence of negative forecasts, which leads to producers increasing the price of commodities and therefore creates a vicious circle. We need to overcome this challenge, and I'm calling on all those involved in economic activities to join hands with us and strictly follow the new policies of this newly launched center of exchange.
This means that all foreign exchange resources, notably from export, must be supervised by the central bank.
The 28,500 toman exchange rate for basic commodities and essential medicines still stands. Other demands for foreign currencies have been carefully categorized, and in the first leg, we are allocating $4 million to specific purposes, which include travel, studying abroad, and research projects, the details of which will be announced shortly.
This is actually a policy that has been successfully implemented by Russia and allowed the ruble to recover its value within a month after its initial plunge at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Russia's success in implementing this policy is mostly due to their system of financial supervision, which ensures that regulatory rules are strictly observed. There are major differences between the economic and monetary structures and approaches of Iran and Russia. And if Iran wants to succeed, it has to take all this into account.
And the good news is, if this policy is successfully implemented, the recovery of the rial is imminent in a situation very similar to what happened in Russia.
Russia's national currency is gaining strength. The ruble is hitting new highs against the U.S. dollar. The Russian economy is making a turnaround despite unprecedented Western sanctions and pressure. Now Iran, taking Russia as a role model, is hoping to do the same. Gizumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The UN Human Rights Chief has voiced concerns about Israeli Prime Minister's so-called judicial reform plan, saying that it's aimed at undermining the regime's judicial system. Volker Turk said the reform will enhance Benjamin Netanyahu's political leverage over judges' selection system. And meanwhile, Netanyahu has denounced UN calls to pause a judicial reform plan as an absurdity. Opponents of the plan say that Netanyahu and his supporters in the Knesset cannot undermine the judiciary just because he's been indicted in several corruption cases. They say that Netanyahu seeks to deflect the fallout from his indictment in 2019 for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The Ukrainian president says his country's forces are maintaining their positions on the front line in the east as Russia claims advances in that region.
It's very important that despite great pressure on our forces, the front line has undergone no change. I thank all our fighters for this, all soldiers and sergeants, officers and generals who are defending on the relevant front theaters.
Zelensky said the Ukrainian forces in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk are doing everything to contain attacks by Russia. This as in Moscow, the Russian Defense Ministry said its forces are advancing in Bakhmut in Donetsk. Last week, Zelensky acknowledged in an interview that there may come a time when mounting losses may make it impractical to keep defending the city. War in Ukraine started February of last year. NATO and the European Union have accused Russia of escalating tensions over Ukraine after Moscow suspended participation in the New START arms control treaty. This is while Moscow insists that the West is to blame for the Ukraine conflict. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
Senior NATO, EU, and Ukrainian officials met in Brussels on Tuesday to discuss the war in Ukraine. The decision by Russia to step back from a 2010 nuclear arms control deal, the New START treaty, was criticised.
More nuclear weapons and less arms control makes the world more dangerous.
Regarding the treaty, some analysts claim it is the West that has been acting as the provocateur. After all, for weeks we have seen growing support amongst Russia's enemies for a large number of long-range missiles to be sent into Ukraine. NATO and the EU have agreed to help Ukraine establish its own weapons procurement system.
The production of warfare material in Europe today, it is still not in accordance with the urgency in the front line.
The US and its allies have provided Ukraine with at least 150 billion euro worth of arms in the past year. There's a growing anti-war sentiment in the EU.
Mostly good for the weapon industry, I guess. So it's almost wars always about making finances and stuff.
We all want peace. It's a crazy situation.
Of course, the prices, the rise of prices, yes, it's very worrying, yes.
I hope like the war is going to be like stopped as soon as possible.
There are regular calls in the European Parliament for peace talks.
12 months later, there is a risk this could become a permanent frozen conflict, not good for Ukrainian civilians or our citizens and businesses, dealing with price hikes and higher bills.
Perhaps there was a certain degree of arrogance on display at the gathering in NATO on Tuesday.
Although this is the first meeting that we held in this format, I already begin to regret that it will cease to exist when Ukraine will become members of both NATO and the EU.
For a whole host of reasons, experts say the chances of that happening anytime soon are slim to none. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italy reaffirms its all-out support for Kiev nearly a year into the Russia-Ukraine war.
I am particularly happy to be here. I strongly wanted to be here on one of the first bilateral missions within the first few months of a new government. I wanted to do so to reiterate Italy's full support in the face of Russian aggression, to reiterate that Italy has no intention of weakening in this matter and will not do so.
Meloni said a supply of aircraft is out of the question for the time being. She said Rome, though, must make such decisions in consultations with its partners. Italian officials said the West has concentrated on providing Kiev with anti-aircraft defense systems. Italy has supplied cash and weapons to assist Ukraine. It's also agreed to send mobile surface-to-air missile systems to Kiev. West has provided countless numbers of military aid packages to Ukraine worth dozens of billions of dollars. Russia has warned that providing such aid will only prolong the war. Thousands of ambulance drivers throughout England and Wales have walked out yet again in an ongoing dispute with the government over pay and staffing. Now, workers throughout industries in the UK have hit the picket lines in recent months, demanding action from their government. Saeed Puriza has your details out of London.
They said they were in it for the long haul, and they have kept their promise. Thousands of ambulance drivers from two separate unions walking off the job across much of England and Wales. Their demand, a pay award that keeps pace with the rising cost of living. The message, that the service is already stretched beyond its limit. Mondays are typically the busiest day for ambulance services across the country, with people now advised to use the 991 service only in an emergency. Despite the disruption, public support for the strikers is strong.
I live with two ambulance drivers and a nurse, so my answer is yes, they deserve more. I think they need more pay, yes.
We're very lucky the people that are working in the hospitals are nice enough to carry on working during the pandemic and not strike earlier, to be fair, because we needed them, they were there when we needed them, and when they need us, we're not there for them, sort of thing. So I think it's a shame.
Despite being on strikes, the crew still leave the picket lines to respond to emergency calls. But the message is, even serious calls will face substantial delays.
The strike action by NHS staff has only intensified in recent weeks, with multiple other walkouts planned for next month. Another single biggest day of action will be the beginning of March, when nurses will once again walk off the job, just like ambulance drivers are doing today.
The unions insist the solution is in the government's hands, a pay increase of about 10%. In the case of nurses, 5% above inflation, that's stubbornly in the double digits. Yet the man holding the strings to the public purse, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, says that's not affordable.
Government's been lots of money on other things, even NHS-wise, that needn't be spent, that could be paying the people that look after everybody, yeah.
February has already seen more than 500,000 people take industrial action. With public strike fatigue nowhere in sight, the walkouts are likely to continue for months. Saeed Puriza, London.
A judge in the United States has rejected a bid by the families of 9/11 victims to seize frozen funds of Afghanistan's central bank. The Manhattan district judge said those people are not entitled to seize $3.5 billion of assets belonging to the Afghan central bank to satisfy court judgments they obtained against the Taliban. George Daniels said that he was constitutionally restrained from finding that the Taliban was Afghanistan's legitimate government. He said U.S. courts lack the power to reach that conclusion. The $7 billion of Afghan central funds, bank funds that are frozen at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. Nearly 3,000 people died in the terror attack on September 11, 2001 in New York, Northern Virginia, and a field in Pennsylvania. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is proposing an immigration policy that could prohibit most asylum seekers from applying for protection in the U.S. The rule would bar migrants from petitioning for protection if they didn't seek safe haven in another country while on their way to the U.S. border. That also meant to discourage migrants from making the dangerous trek through Latin America. The Biden administration slammed for pursuing former President Donald Trump's anti-migrant policy. U.S. government was also condemned for flouting its domestic and international legal obligations. Thousands of migrant families were separated and deported to their original countries under former President Donald Trump. Malcolm X was the iconic leader of an African-American Muslims and civil rights activist who was assassinated 50 years ago. Now his daughter says she intends to sue the FBI, the CIA, New York police, and others for his death.
For years, our family has fought for the truth to come to light concerning his murder, and we'd like our father to receive the justice that he deserves. The truth about the circumstances leading to the death of our father is important not only to his family, but to many followers, many admirers, many who look to him for guidance, for love. And it is our hope that litigation of this case will finally provide some unanswered questions. We want justice served for our father.
Chabal has accused various federal and New York government agencies of fraudulently concealing evidence. She claims evidence shows agencies conspire to assassinate Malcolm X. Chabal says she is seeking $100 million in damages. Malcolm X was killed on stage while preparing to deliver a speech. Soon after, some of his associates said they believe various government agencies were aware of the assassination plot and let it happen anyway. In 2021, a New York State judge threw out the convictions of two men who mistakenly spent decades in prison for the murder. Judge said there had been a miscarriage of justice. Peru's top prosecutor general says an investigation has been formalized to look into criminal allegations against former President Pedro Castillo. Former head of state's accused of crimes including influence peddling, organized crime, and being an accomplice to collusion committed during his tenure. The Attorney General's office also kicked off probes into two of Castillo's former ministers for graft. Castillo has been in detention since December. He denies the charges. Castillo's ouster sparked a wave of violent protests throughout the country, leaving some 60 people dead. Protesters have been calling for the resignation of Castillo's successor, President Dina Boluarte. They want early elections and the shuttering of Congress and a new constitution. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, more than 100 Tory MPs could rebel over Rishi Sunak's Northern Ireland protocol deal with the European Union. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. Boris Johnson is on collision course with Rishi Sunak over the Prime Minister's attempts to reach a deal with Brussels over the Northern Ireland Protocol. The former Prime Minister is bitterly opposed to Mr. Sunak's plans to abandon the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, which gives ministers power to rip up parts of the protocol and ignore European Union rules. In a move that could trigger infighting within the Conservative Party over Brexit, a source close to Boris Johnson told Sky News, his general thinking is that it would be a great mistake to drop the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. As Rishi Sunak battles to reach a deal over the protocol, senior government sources claim that if there is a deal, the bill introduced by Boris Johnson when he was Prime Minister would be redundant. If we can find a way to satisfactorily resolve this issue with the protocol, then you wouldn't need the bill, a senior government official has said. But we haven't resolved them yet. As well as the potential mutiny by the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, senior pro-Brexit Conservative MPs are warning of a massive Tory rebellion if Rishi Sunak's deal keeps a role for the European Court of Justice. Boris Johnson's legislation currently in the House of Lords, where it is likely to be face amendments by anti-Brexit peers, includes stripping the European Court of Justice of any jurisdiction over Northern Ireland. James Duddridge, a former Brexit minister and a leading ally of Boris Johnson, told Sky News the number of Tory MPs prepared to rebel could be as many as 100. It wouldn't just be the so-called Spartans, James Duddridge said. There will be a large number of Brexiteers, possibly the majority of the parliamentary party and potentially running into trouble figures. However, a big Conservative rebellion against the deal on the protocol would be unlikely to kill it, since Labour leader Keir Starmer has let it be known that Labour is prepared to back the deal. Earlier, in Munich, Germany, questioned about progress on his talks with EU leaders and Northern Ireland's political parties on the Northern Ireland Protocol, Rishi Sunak said, "There's still work to do. There are still challenges to work through. We have not resolved all of these issues." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Rishi Sunak has been warned that more than 100 Tory MPs could rebel over a deal with the European Union to help break the post-Brexit deadlock in Northern Ireland, as Boris Johnson, former Prime Minister, launched a major intervention calling for him to take a tougher line with Brussels. Pressure is growing on the Prime Minister, as government sources said. Tense talks in Downing Street over the weekend on overhauling the Northern Ireland Protocol were yet to yield a breakthrough. They cautioned that the hoped-for timetable of an agreement being announced on Monday and a House of Commons vote on Tuesday was at risk of slipping. One insider said, "We're ready to go," but claimed that nervousness about opposition by the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, and Tory backbenchers was to blame for the hold-up. The Irish Deputy Prime Minister Michael Martin flew to Brussels on Sunday night for a meeting with the European Commission Vice President Maroš Šefčovič, according to reports by Irish broadcaster RTE. He was due to be at the European Commission for a meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council before the first anniversary of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. There was a backlash on Sunday, 19th of February, over details leaking out about concessions said to have been made by the British government and a demand by Brussels that Prime Minister Sunak axe a controversial bill designed to unilaterally rip up some Brexit arrangements in Northern Ireland. In the first pronouncement by Boris Johnson on Brexit since he left office, a source close to him said he believed it would be a great mistake to drop the legislation and hinted that it should be maintained as leverage over the European Union. James Duddridge, a former Brexit minister and close ally of Boris Johnson, said talk of the European Court of Justice retaining a role would also be a wedge to fulfilling Brexit. It won't just be the so-called Spartans, referring to the nickname given to the few dozen diehard purists. There will be a large number of Brexiteers, possibly the majority of the parliamentary party, and potentially running into trouble figures. There is no formal requirement to hold a vote, but No. 10 Downing Street is considering holding one, given concerns that they may end up being forced to, and would win regardless due to Labour's commitment to support any deal. Just hours after Boris Johnson's intervention, other Conservatives quickly sided with him. David Frost, Britain's former chief Brexit negotiator, stressed there was no deadline for talks on overhauling the protocol. He said Rishi Sunak should push on with the protocol bill so that our negotiators are in the strongest possible position. Simon Clark, the former Levelling Up Secretary, signalled that he would not support anything that keeps Northern Ireland subject to EU law or in the single market, and said the protocol bill remains a clean solution to ensure all parts of Britain are treated equally. Dozens of MPs in the hardline group of Brexiteers known as the European Research Group are planning to meet on Tuesday to discuss details of any concessions said to have been made by the British government. Despite widespread annoyance at Boris Johnson's intervention among his critics within the Conservative Party, Penny Mordaunt, the House of Commons leader, claimed it was not entirely unhelpful. But some Tories want Rishi Sunak to keep the legislation halted. Robert Buckland, a former Justice Secretary, said there was a narrow supporting legal argument for the bill when it was progressing through Parliament last year. But he added, now that the negotiations are real and progressing, I think that the situation has significantly changed. The bill is a dead letter. Others have dismissed the pronouncement by Boris Johnson on Brexit. George Osborne, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, said Johnson was interested solely in becoming Prime Minister again. George Osborne told Channel 4's Andrew Neil, he wants to bring down Sunak and he will use any instrument to do it. If the Northern Ireland negotiations are that instrument, he will pick it up and hit Sunak over the head with it. Naomi Long, the leader of the Alliance Party, also accused Boris Johnson of thinking about himself rather than the legacy of the protocol. He created this mess, he needs to sit this one out, she said. The Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, has kept quiet since its meeting with Rishi Sunak in Belfast on Friday, after which its leader warned that the plan proposed currently falls short of what would be acceptable.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners. And on the threshold of the blessed month of Sha'ban, how about reflecting upon a maxim bequeathed to us for our guidance by the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Beware of the flight of blessings, for nothing that runs away is returned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, moderation in food and sleep. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of moderation in food and sleep in the Islamic lifestyle. It is necessary that when we want to adopt an Islamic lifestyle, we act moderately in our actions, and we are moderate, especially when it comes to the food and sleep. We do not oversleep, we do not overeat. The reason is that those who oversleep or overeat, they are damaging their health. On top of that, it also damages the soul as well. Whereas in one of the sayings of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, it is said that the person who eats a lot, he basically is damaging himself. And this eating a lot or overeating causes the hardness of the heart and the hardness of the soul. Therefore, it is necessary to have control when we are eating, and we do not overeat. Even if we like something, we should not overeat the things. Therefore, it is necessary to control the eating part. On the other hand, when it is said that we need to be moderate in eating, it means that we need to consume the halal food. The reason is the halal food which has been obliged by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala upon us to earn halal, to eat halal food, to eat specific things that are halal in the food. It is because that there is a moderation in these foods, and it is not something that can be a harmful for us if we adopt the moderate way. Therefore, the things that are forbidden, for example, the pork is forbidden, there are other things that are forbidden, it is because they are not the way of moderation. The animal itself, the food itself has effect, and that's why it is said, you are what you eat. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of moderation in food and sleep. We mentioned that, obviously, it is said that you are what you eat, and therefore we must control our food, we must control what we eat, we must control the diet that we are using. On the other hand, we also must control our sleeping timings, and we should not oversleep. Generally, it is said, it is recommended that we must sleep at 9 p.m. and to wake up at 3 a.m. Now, in today's world, we cannot imagine such timings. And the reason is, which is said scientifically or medically, it is said that we must sleep, we must go to bed at 9 p.m., 9 o'clock in the night. And after that, to wake up at 3 o'clock or the 4 a.m., it is because the body is creating something. For example, when body it needs to create insulin in our cells to control the sugar, that is the time. Similarly, there are many things that are, we can say, reformed by the body, that are restructured, rebuilt, and the things that are created in the body, the best time is from 9 p.m. to 3 a.m. in the morning. Therefore, it is necessary to use these 6-7 hours of the night to sleep well. And even if we have something to do, for example, I'm awake till 12 o'clock in order to finish an assignment. So it is better to sleep at night and wake up at to sleep at 9 and wake up at 3, and from 3 onwards I can continue the things that I'm doing. Therefore, in the Islam, the things that are said that you need to have the sleep, you must sleep on time, the emphasis on this and to have the moderation is because it will not take us to a level where we will have the qiswatul qalb, which is known as hard-hearted, or the other thing is to have extra lust, which is known as the shahwa. So in order to control both things, it is better to follow the moderate way. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
South Korea, the name conjures up a thriving economy from which many popular brands come. The East Asian country is usually referred to as a success story of a close cooperation with the United States, in contrast with North Korea. The country's booming economy in recent decades, however, has emboldened the authorities to lecture the world, just like their American masters. Their throwaway and sometimes hostile remarks have contributed to the growing tensions in the world. In a rather recent case in mid-January, the president of South Korea described Iran as the enemy of the United Arab Emirates and called Tehran its biggest threat and compared it to North Korea, which he declared as Seoul's biggest threat. Regardless of Yoon Suk-yeol's groundless accusations against the Islamic Republic, The question is if South Korea is as good and innocent as it tries to peddle, with no skeletons in the closet. An innocent country that the long arm of fate has put next to North Korea, their biggest threat, to borrow a phrase from Yol. Perhaps one of the notorious cases of atrocities committed by South Korea dates back to February 12, 1968, when the country's marine unit launched a raid on Phong Nhi and Phong Nhat, two villages in central Vietnam. The ruthless raid left scores of bodies, all unarmed civilians. John M. Capanelli, a U.S. Marine investigator of the time, wrote in the declassified documents on February 18, 1968, the victims of this innocent were defenseless civilians, the great majority of which were women and children, who were murdered as they pled for their lives. He added, in an attempt to placate the survivors and relatives of the dead and wounded, the executive officer of the South Korean Marine Battalion offered his apologies and provided 30 bags of rice to the district chief. In 2021, nearly a half century after the Vietnam War ended, victims of the massacre at Phong Nhi and Phong Nhat decided to seek compensation from the Seoul government. In the words of Nguyen Thi Thong, a survivor of the Phong Nhi and Phong Nhat massacre, "I have never been free from the nightmare of the day when South Korean troops came to our village. But the South Korean government has never once visited our village and never once asked us what happened." The Phong Nhi and Phong Nhat massacres were followed by the Hamai massacre, where South Korean troops killed over 100 villagers on February 25, 1968. Again, mostly women, children, and the elderly. South Korea maintains it has found no evidence of civilian killings in its wartime records. That's while, by many credible accounts, South Korean forces claimed an estimated 9,000 innocent lives in total in over 45 incidents of massacre spotted throughout Vietnam. Widespread accounts of sexual assaults also exist, with some studies estimating that up to 10,000 Vietnamese women and girls were raped by South Korean soldiers. Dictator Park Chung-hee sought to build a stable South Korean government, and so he agreed to take a leading role in the Vietnam War in exchange for American military support in the Korean Peninsula and economic support for his ambitious development plans. The estimated $1 billion U.S. dollars worth of American aid and other war-related income was a vital lifeline for the crumbling Korean economy. But Vietnam is not the only country the South Koreans left their bloody mark on. In January 2000, The Guardian ran a frontline page headline, "U.S. and South Korea Accused of War Atrocities," for an inquiry that had uncovered the secret of a series of attacks carried out by South Korea on North Korea. According to the research, South Korean troops attacked the North a year before the Korean War broke out. More than 250 guerrillas from the South reportedly launched an attack on North Korean villages along the East Coast in June 1949. It was only one of numerous small-scale conflicts instigated by the South. In the early days of the Korean War, Seoul also carried out wholesale executions of its own citizens. A slaughter believed to have killed 100,000 or more leftists and supposed sympathizers, usually without charge or trial, in a few weeks in mid-1950. In 2019, the New York Times opened up with another long-suppressed case on Jeju, an island off the southern coast of South Korea. In 1947, a group of Jeju Islanders rose up against police brutality and called for a unified Korean government, after the country had been divided into the North and the South. The police, however, responded with an extermination campaign, branding the insurgents as communist agitators. Zhizhou became a human slaughterhouse, with an estimated 30,000 people losing their lives, about one-tenth of the island's population. In fact, not only has Seoul been a threat to the neighboring countries over the past decades, it showed the least possible respect for its own people's lives. The atrocities committed at Brothers Home, a state-funded facility for vagrants where thousands were enslaved and abused from the 1960s to the 80s, is a case in point. In August 2022, South Korea's Truth and Reconciliation Commission found the country's past military governments responsible for the atrocities. From the 1960s to the 80s, South Korean military dictators ordered roundups to beautify the streets. Consequently, thousands, including homeless and disabled people, as well as children, were snatched off the streets and brought to facilities where they were detained and forced to work. Many inmates were enslaved, raped, and in hundreds of cases, beaten to death or left to die. So far, no one has been held accountable for hundreds of deaths, rapes, and beatings at Brothers. At the same time, while some South Korean presidents have made apologetic statements about the country's participation in the Vietnam War, they have fallen short of acknowledging the massacres, years after trying to deny or hide them. Ironically, they have instead been busy branding this or that country as good or bad. Isn't it time for Seoul to acknowledge its own atrocities committed within and without the country?
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Scientists are once again warned that by 2030, the emission of greenhouse gases should be reduced by half around the world in order to avoid the worst of climate change. They say the moving countries on the current dangerous path will add another 3 degrees Celsius to the current level of global warming, which is twice more than the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius that was set at the COP21 Paris Climate Summit. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Scientists have warned the return of El Niño climate phenomena later this year will cause global temperatures to rise off the chart and deliver unprecedented heat waves. Early forecasts suggest El Niño will return later in 2023, exacerbating extreme weather around the globe and making it very likely the world would exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius of global warming. The hottest year in recorded history, 2016, was driven by a major El Niño. It is part of a natural oscillation driven by ocean temperatures and winds in the Pacific Ocean,
which switches between El Niño, its cooler counterpart La Niña, and neutral conditions. The last 3 years have seen an unusual run of consecutive La Niña events. This year is already forecast to be hotter than 2022, which global data sets rank as the fifth or sixth hottest year on record. But El Niño occurs during the Northern Hemisphere winter, and its heating effect takes months to be felt, meaning 2024 is much more likely to set a new global temperature record. The greenhouse gases emitted by human activities have driven up average global temperatures by about 1.2 degrees Celsius to date. This has already led to catastrophic impacts around the world, from searing heat waves in the United States and Europe to devastating floods in Pakistan and Nigeria, harming millions of people. Professor Adam Scaife, the head of long-range prediction at the UK Met Office, said the fluctuating impacts of the El Niño and La Niña cycle would be seen in many regions of the world. Professor Scaife added, "Science can now tell us when these things are coming months ahead, so we really do need to use it and be more prepared, from having readiness of emergency services right down to what crops to plant." While El Niño would supercharge extreme weather, the degree of exacerbation was under debate among scientists. Professor Bill Maguire of University College London said, "When El Niño arrives, the extreme weather that has rampaged across our planet in 2021 and 2022 will pale into insignificance." While Professor Tim Palmer of University of Oxford said, "The correlation between extreme weather and global mean temperatures is not that strong, but the thermodynamic effects of climate change are going to make the anomalies we get from an El Niño year just that much more extreme." Climate modelling results issued in early January by Australia's Bureau of Meteorology indicated the country could swing from 3 years of above-average rainfall to one of the hottest, driest El Niño periods on record, increasing the risk of severe heat waves, droughts and wildfires. In December, the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, rated the odds of an El Niño forming by August to October as 66%. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Britain's Meteorological Office has forecast this year will be warmer than last year and one of the hottest on record. Predictions suggest it will be the 10th year in a row the global temperature is at least 1 degree Celsius above average. Scientific evidence shows that climate change is driving up global temperatures. In July, the United Kingdom recorded its hottest temperature ever, with the mercury hitting 40.2 degrees Celsius, that is 104.3 degrees Fahrenheit, at Heathrow Airport in West London. The heat wave also sparked bushfires in and around London, setting houses ablaze. Some countries across Europe had been struggling to put out wildfires and at times have been criticised by activists for not doing enough to combat the climate crisis and its effects. Although the general take is that the world is heading towards a warmer year, scientists are professionally cautious when asked how the coming summer will be. Meteorologist Andy Hill told Anadolu News Agency that it is not possible to give a confident forecast, but also cited a report by the American Meteorological Society, which points to changes in the monthly average to understand that 2023 will see the world entering an El Niño, a periodic event that involves above-average sea surface temperatures across East and Central Equatorial Pacific Ocean. The Met Office's Nick Dunstan, who has led the 2023 global temperature forecast, said, "The global temperature over the last 3 years has been influenced by the effect of a prolonged La Niña, where cooler than average sea surface temperatures occur in the tropical Pacific Ocean."
Nick Dunstan added, "For the next year, our climate model is indicating an end to the three consecutive years with a La Niña state and a return to relatively warmer conditions in parts of the tropical Pacific Ocean. This shift is likely to lead to global temperatures in 2023 being warmer than 2022. Maximiliano Herrera, a meteorologist who focuses on climate data, agreed that the probability of warmer-than-average conditions occurring is greater for cooler conditions. According to data collected by Herrera, just this month, the warmest January day ever was recorded in at least 8 European countries, including Poland, Denmark, the Czech Republic, Netherlands, Belarus, Lithuania, and Latvia. The website of Business Insider India writes, "If you ever shared a common working space with someone, you know there's at least a 10-degree difference between setting the AC at 21 degrees C and 24 degrees C, even if science can't prove it. However, the effects of such excruciating yet minuscule change disappear once you leave the room, something that unfortunately cannot be said for global rising temperatures. What's worse is that the sheer scale of damage the global warming can inflict is incomparable for even the tiniest temperature increments. We stand to lose entire countries to sea level rise and immeasurable species to habitat destruction, with billions more getting exposed to tragedy if the 1.5 degrees Celsius Paris warning target is breached." And a new UK Met study shows that the spiral may begin from just next year. If you aren't familiar with El Niño and La Niña, they're basically extremely large-scale weather patterns in the Pacific Ocean that can disrupt worldwide weather and even affect marine life to a considerable extent. Both affect west-blowing trade winds along the equator, which help in moving warmer water from South America towards Asia. And the effect and position of this warm water butterflies into creating distinct weather phenomena all over the world. We've been experiencing La Niña conditions for the past 3 years, something that is due to change very, very soon. And this is concerning because La Niñas are generally associated with a temporary cooling effect on temperatures. That's right, the last 3 years were supposed to be among the cool ones. Thank you, global warming. Once the weather patterns oscillate back to El Niño, that is associated with warmer weather patterns, you best believe that sweater days might have to take a temporary back seat in some parts of the world over the next few years. For reference, El Niño year of 2016 was the hottest year on record since 1850, and also the year where the Great Barrier Reef faced the largest die-off event, again fueled by El Niño.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Academics who criticise the Israeli regime and who speak out in support of the Palestinian people are being targeted and smeared. Some have had their professional careers ruined by outrageous calumnies. The prestigious Harvard University is one of the institutions where pro-Palestinian